Well, good morning and welcome to our weekly To Know Insights call on the impact of COVID-19. The media headlines are proclaiming an end to the lockdown, focusing on Boris Johnson's claim that he's ending our long national hibernation. Pubs and restaurants are to open, so are hairdressers, and the 2 metre social distancing rule has been reduced to 1 metre plus. Theoretically, it should be a revolution in the way we are allowed to behave, but delve beneath the headlines and there's a lot of uncertainty. Public health officials like Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance are clear that this might have to be reversed if the infection rates go in the wrong direction. And they're clear it will be a surprise if life gets back to anything like normal before next spring. It certainly won't just be the usual experience of dropping in for a pint or a glass of wine at your local. You may have to book, and it will be table service only. Many restaurants are busily installing screens. Meanwhile, COVID-19 is tightening its grip in many other parts of the world, and evidence of feared second spikes is emerging in many places. We're privileged today to have another great panel to look closely at all of this. The Right Honourable Brian Mulroney is a Teneo Senior Advisor and former Canadian Prime Minister. He'll be discussing the failures of international cooperation and his observations of how business can operate in these troubled times. Oliver Shah is the Sunday Times Business Editor. He'll be sharing his thoughts on businesses and sectors that will thrive and struggle in the coming year. Amber Rudd, who's a regular on the call, is a Teneo Senior Advisor and former Home Secretary. She'll be giving the usual update on the political situation in the UK. And Wolfgang Piccoli, co-president of Teneo's risk practice, will analyse trends in handling COVID-19 around the world. But before that, and we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right-hand side of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. Oliver, that doesn't mean you though. So that done, let's get to it. Prime Minister Mulroney, let's start with you. It's often said the experience of Canada is like that of being in bed with an elephant. How have you found looking over the border to the States is dealing with this? And do you regret their lack of global leadership?
Well, as you know, Craig, that all of the American presidents, certainly since Roosevelt, have been internationalists, free traders, and people who brought along allies with respect and dignity to form things like NATO and earlier the United Nations and so on. And I was privileged to work with three of them, President Reagan and President George Herbert Walker Bush, and Bill Clinton, and all of them were in that great American tradition has existed since the last 75 years. There's been a big change, as we all know, since 1916, since the last election in Washington. President Trump, and he didn't steal the presidency he wanted. And when people voted for him, they knew what they were getting. He proudly really asserts himself as to be a provincialist, a protectionist, and in many ways, a unilateralist. This is what the Make America Great Again is all about. This is the slogan that defines his presidency. And, you know, when you have a president of the United States who is prouder of his association with the president of North Korea than he is with the prime minister of the United Kingdom, you know, you've got yourself a real problem, and certainly a variation from the past 75 years in terms of American leadership, which certainly when I was there, and I'm sure that when Amber was there as well, that, you know, people, friends and allies automatically accepted American, the assertion of American leadership of the Western Alliance and of the free world and in the G7 and elsewhere because of their economic power and their military outreach, but also because of the manner in which they exercised power and authority to convince other nations like the United Kingdom and Canada come along in a great strategic initiative, whatever it might have been. And it wasn't bullying of allies or neglecting allies or insulting allies at any time. It was a pathway to success led by the Americans, and we all, with good reason, accepted their very moderate and thoughtful and generous outlook vis-a-vis the Allies. Well, you know, that's changed. And as I say, President Trump didn't steal the election. He won it fair and square. So that's where we are with America. And I tell you, the difference between the relationship between myself, for example, and President Reagan, and the Mr. Trudeau's job with Mr. Trump, there's a big, big difference in how it all works out. So this leads to the challenge, our big global challenge today on the virus. The Americans, who normally would lead the world in everything, certainly the free world in everything, came late to this party. And many critics and observers say that the results were chaotic and oftentimes contradictory. For example, yesterday, while President Trump was in Arizona speaking to 4,000 young people in a hot hall, all jammed together like sardines, no one wearing a mask, his four principal advisors led by Dr. Fauci were before Congress testifying that how indispensable it is for people to wear masks and observe the protocols that exist, that must exist throughout this thing. And people arguing on the president's behalf that no, he was just joking when he said he wanted to stop or reduce testing. And he showed up, of course, without a mask. I don't know whether that's a sign of leadership in his mind or virility or what. But his principal advisors say that this is extremely damaging. By the way, this is the kind of thing that impressed our friend, the president of Brazil. And guess what the hell is happening in Brazil? Exactly what's happening in the United States of America. Here we have the United States with 4% of the world's population, having 25% of the world's infections, and 25% of the world's deaths, with 4% of the population. I don't know what that says to you, but what it tells me is that things may have been handled much differently. And it would have been the case had there been much greater cooperation with the Allies earlier on. Now, it's true that the Chinese horsed around with this big time, and caused all of us enormous problems. It's growing progressively clear that that China withheld vital information, and it could have slowed the growth of this enormously. But it's also true that some of the nations led by the United States didn't react swiftly and as effectively as they could. Compare the United States, and I know the numbers are entirely different and the size is entirely different, with New Zealand, for example, and think what might have happened had people abided by the statement by Vice President Biden in January that an epidemic was coming and we had to prepare for it and do something about it now. Everybody laughed at him. And so what the hell is Joseph trying to say here? Spoiling our party kind of thing. Well, the party turned out to be pretty tragic. You know, the United States this morning would be approaching, I haven't looked this morning, but would be approaching 125,000 deaths, with many, many more forecasts. And one of the problems now, after having gone through that tragedy, or partially through it, now everybody in the southern and southwestern United States, they want to reopen. Reopening is the key. And I see the United Kingdom did that yesterday, I think, in the House of Commons. Well, you better be bloody careful, because if you look at the numbers that are going on in Arizona, in Florida, California, Texas, these are very damaging, which indicate that the greatest mistake that we could make now would be to reopen too quickly. Because if we do, we may have to shut the whole bloody thing down again in August or September, having lost all of the tremendous sacrifice that people from around the world have made to try and bring this under control. So The answer, of course, is a vaccine. And there again, leadership, international leadership of friends is vital. What's going on? We need a vaccine. This is the answer, ultimate answer to this. And I'm pleased to note that it appears that, you know, at Oxford, in England, very, very very promising results coming from the brilliance of their scholars and their people. Same is true, of course, of the United States and Canada and elsewhere. But the answer has to be a vaccine. And if we had cooperated initially, led by the Americans, the onslaught of this, we had done that the way the scientists are cooperating to find a vaccine for us, I think we'd be much further ahead. And so the United States today is not a happy place, and with good reason.
Huge amount to chew over there, and some very direct comments that really appreciated, and I think will spark a lot of debate and questions. We're going to move on to Oliver Shah now. Oliver, as a business journalist, you spend your working life talking and analyzing businesses. Now we're so deep into this crisis, what are your observations on the trends in business? What do you see?
Yeah, thank you, Craig, and good morning. If we step back and look at the past 4 months, the question people ask again and again is, how is this going to change the business landscape? Is business going to be reformed as a result of this? My view is, in the short term, yes. In the long term, no. And if you look at it on an overarching basis, I think the coronavirus crisis is going to accelerate structural trends that were already reshaping business. It's going to speed things up, and it's long term going to widen the gap between the winners and the losers. I'll unpack that briefly. We've seen huge amounts of government stimulus, unprecedented intervention in a whole range of sectors. You've got the furlough scheme paying 9 million people's wages. You've got the self-employed support scheme paying a further 2.5 million people's wages. You've got treasury-backed loans under the B bills, C bills schemes, supporting a load of SMEs and even bigger companies. You're soon going to have the first bailout of a really strategically significant company direct by the Treasury in the form of Tata Steel. So at the moment, we've got a situation where the landscape has been redrawn by state intervention. I think in the short and medium term, you're going to see corporate restraint on a scale you never usually see. There's a stigma around paying dividends, even companies that haven't taken direct taxpayer support. You saw the banks surrender 9 billion dividends in April or May after the regulator leaned on them to conserve their capital. You've seen insurers not paying dividends. It's almost, in the meantime, socially unacceptable to pay dividends while the broader ecosystem is so supported by taxpayers' money. You've got restraint on pay. You've got corporate behavior being reined in all kinds of ways. I do think that will pass in time, and I think animal spirits are very hard to hold down for any prolonged period of time. As you see the furlough scheme withdrawn, and as you see the various treasury-backed loan schemes reducing in their use by companies, you will see the normal state of affairs start to reassert itself. And I think longer term, you're going to see a huge widening of the gap between winners and losers. If you look at the economy in the UK going into this crisis, certain industries were already very, very weak. Retailing for the past 5-10 years has been on an accelerating slope down. Retail property, the ownership of shopping centres, malls, high street has been a terrible place to be. The restaurant trade has been harder and harder. Old industries like steelmaking, some elements of heavy manufacturing, which were traditionally, you know, 30, 40 years ago, a big employment base in the UK, have been dwindling and dwindling in a globalised world. And I think next 5 years, we're going to see a lot of those industries swept away. It's going to pose huge challenges for the government in terms of how do you replace a lot of blue-collar jobs outside London. And you're going to see the rise and rise of tech, particularly US big tech. If you look at the share prices of the FANGs, as they're called in the US, Facebook and Apple and the others, they've absolutely boomed in the past 4 months, while a load of other share prices have tanked. I think the The big tech companies, which comprise about 20% of the S&P, have almost single-handedly dragged the S&P up onto a mini rally in the past few months. And that's a reflection of the fact people can see the economy is moving ever more towards intangible services, ever more towards these kind of connected devices. And it's going to be a huge challenge for governments outside the US because increasingly the money is being made offshore. Consumers are buying things more and more online. The gatekeepers of this world are the big tech giants. And it's going to pose very big challenges for governments in terms of tax revenue, employment, and how you try and support legacy industries and how you try and revitalize industries that have been really walloped by the lockdown over the past 4 months. That's my view in a nutshell.
Thanks, Oliver. That's fascinating. Lots of really interesting insights there. Amber, let's move to the UK political situation. We've seen huge moves from the government in the last couple of days. It feels to me, sort of reading between the lines, that they've had to drag the scientists kicking and screaming to this position. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that is fair. I mean, the government has been longing to arrive at this position to begin to say we're unlocking, partly because, on a trivial basis, perhaps the daily press conferences have not played to the government's strengths. But the press conference that we had from the Prime Minister yesterday, there was a lot of yes, but from the scientists attached. And we've seen that sort of coming out again more in the past 24 hours. I mean, the bold facts are that we still have high levels of infection compared to when we started the lockdown. There are still high risks out there. It's just that they've come down tremendously since our height of just a few weeks ago. But the real driver in number 10 at the moment is fear over unemployment. We currently have 3 million people claiming universal credit, of which 1 million are on low incomes and are claiming it, and about 2 million are fully unemployed. And the government estimates now is that we could go to 4.5 million unemployed. And that is a staggering number to think about. Between 2010 and 2020, we were able, as a government, pretty much every week to say, every month rather, to say employment is up again. And that was always a bulwark against opposition. But the whole issue of unemployment now is looming as the big issue for Number 10 to handle. So if the government estimate could be 4.5 million unemployed, that's their central estimate. Some people are thinking it could be much larger. And listening to Oliver's comments, I'm afraid I think that is right. With 9 million people having their wages paid, and with the next 2 to 3 months being eased off, we will be starting to see some large numbers of unemployment, which would be so dramatic for the UK. So they need to undo the lockdown. They need to get people back to work. They need to get the economy moving again. So they're willing to take the risk, despite what the scientists are saying. I do think that one of the assessments they've made is true, which is we know very little about the virus, really. But one of the things we do know is that you are unlikely to get it, very unlikely to get it outside. So over the summer, I think that that will be fine. I mean, I think that people's behaviour has changed. There's lots of guidance coming out, lots of can you be 2 metres, can you be 1 metre, which households. I think that generally the public will make their own judgments. But while most of this is taking place outside, not inside in a cinema or a theatre, which is going to, they're going to struggle to open, I think that we won't see, and the calculation is that we won't see a second virus wave. But you know, the estimate at number 10 is that we need to get that going to head off the scale of unemployment that we could otherwise have, and as Oliver set out, the huge risks that are also going with it. So they're also thinking about what else we can do to stimulate the economy. One of the things that we have seen more of over the past few days is thinking about the planning. And Craig, as you and I know, planning rules being lessened with a Conservative Party is very, very hard because the Conservative MPs tend to be in the seats where the new houses need to be built, etc. And that can lead to quite fearsome opposition. So I would expect a political battle over planning because the Prime Minister and his aides will want to change planning laws. If you're going to have a fiscal stimulus, of course you can do it with money, but you can also do it with deregulation of planning. And that is such a tantalizing thing for a government to be able to reach and not to have to pay for. So we'll be seeing more battles over that side as well. Finally, just a comment on the tech giants, if I may, as well, in response to Oliver's comments, is that I thought that the row over the app with Matt Hancock was very indicative over who's in charge. who's in charge. And when it comes to apps, which platform they can be used on and how they work, the tech giants are very much in charge. And as we spend more and more of our time, our business effort, etc., on tech, we provide more and more opportunity to demonstrate that really it's the tech giants in charge. And we are struggling to tax them. We saw Steve Mnuchin withdraw from the agreement to try to find an agreement on taxing tech giants. I think this is going to be a really big international problem going forward. And as Prime Minister Mulroney pointed out in his such helpful remarks, is that with no leadership from the US, it is unknown how we can possibly address that.
Thanks, Amber. Really useful and fascinating. Wolf, let's come to you now. We're seeing the numbers in the UK dropping down and down, the number of deaths, the number of infections, but that's not the picture internationally really at the moment, is it? Can you spell out that a bit more?
Sure. Well, we reached the 9.3 million positive cases worldwide. As Prime Minister Mulroney mentioned, 25% of them are in the US, 2.3 million. But I think what is more interesting is two other factors. Last Sunday, we had in one single day 183,000 new cases. That is a peak from the beginning of the crisis. So the wave is still strong. And if you look at the progression, it took us 3 months to get to 1 million positive cases at the beginning of the crisis. Then we did the jump from 1 million to 2 million in 13 days. Now we are doing jumps from last time we did one from 8 million to 9 in 7 days. So the spread is still very, very strong. In terms of the US, a couple of observations there. If you look at the week average, in comparison to last week, the US infection are up 30%. Is Arizona, is Florida, California alone yesterday, 5,000 cases. Yesterday in the US was the biggest jump in positive cases for the past 2 months. What is driving this is a community spreading and very different kind of communities. A church in Oregon, a strip joint in Wisconsin, bars in Baton Rouge, a summer camp in Colorado Springs, and also we start seeing cases in Vegas after the reopening of the casinos, hotels, and restaurants. But it's very much about community spreading. For business, well, Apple has been forced to close its shops in Arizona, in Florida, in South and North Carolina. In Texas, the governor is urging people to stay at home again. So there is disruption to business, despite all the push to reopen and lifting restriction. Dr. Fauci has been mentioned earlier. Yesterday, he mentioned that the next 2 weeks are critical for the US in terms of his ability to tackle this new spread. Closer to home, I think one story to monitor for us, and again, the timeline is the next 2 weeks, is what is happening in Germany. So we have a new outbreak in North Rhine-Westphalia. It's around the biggest meat production facility in Germany, 7,000 workers, 1,500 positive. So now why we should care about North Rhine-Westphalia? Well, because if the Germans are not able to stop the outbreak, now they impose a lockdown locally, 360,000 people involved in this new lockdown. If it spreads, North Rhine-Westphalia is 18 million people, is the biggest state in Germany, is the size of the Netherlands. What is also interesting for business here is the fact that lots of the workers are subcontractors. The food industry is super competitive in Germany, generally employing workers from Eastern Europe, living in very poor conditions, and not being paid with the low minimum, with the minimum wage. Well, as a result of the outbreak yesterday in Germany, now there is a debate about banning the meat industry from subcontracting. So maybe the era of cheap food here is becoming a bit under question as a result of this crisis. As Amber mentioned before, in terms of the UK, it's all the focus is about reopening. But if you look at the numbers, yesterday alone was 874 new cases. If you compare to some of the key big countries in Europe, it's almost double. France yesterday was 259, Italy was 113. Germany was above because of this new outbreak, was around 700, but Germany went down to 160. So again, the numbers are quite high. The world testing tracking system is certainly not world quality, as Boris Johnson promised. It's still actually very much a work in progress. And one final thing from me, which I think is critical, and we discussed in previous calls, we are seeing more studies coming out. There is a very good one by Harvard University about the impact of the coronavirus so far on the economy, specifically on consumer spending. And they used all sorts of new indicators, given the limited time lag they had. What is clear is that the key driver in the reduction of spending is the fear of the virus itself. It's not the restriction imposed by the governments, and it's not income. Indeed, in the US, they realized that those who cut most of their spending were actually the wealthy people and not the low income. And obviously that in turn had a negative impact on the low income. And also in terms of restriction, what is also interesting to see, and that is a different study than in Europe, that where psychology, personal feelings are key. If you look at Sweden, where a lockdown, as you know, was never imposed, mobility went down as much as it went down in other Nordic countries where the restrictions were imposed. In Italy, mobility went down further in the southern region, where the outbreak was not as strong as it was in Lombardy, in Piedmont, and so on. So what I'm trying to say here, we are reopening. If we really want to win the economic battle, the psychology of the consumer here, and not so much the lifting or restriction per se, and especially reassuring the consumer about the trajectory of the virus, is critical to get business up and running. And let me stop it there.
Okay, there's huge amounts to chew over in all of those comments. I'm going to start with the thing that really, really jumped out at me, which was unemployment that you were talking about with Amber. You were saying that in the UK, unemployment could go up to 4.5 million. And we've recently seen sort of frictional levels where it's almost been as low as it could possibly be in this country. And we also, a lot of us have memories of the 1980s and that kind of thing, of how bad unemployment got and the impact that had on societies. And I'm interested in you talking to that and how much of a problem that is. And then I'd like to bring you in, Prime Minister Mulroney, as well, about the concerns about that around the world. But Amber, first, the unemployment point.
I mean, it's no question it would be catastrophic. I mean, it would be very, very damaging. It's, you know, the business about people being on furlough at the moment has been quite calming for people because, you know, some people have rather enjoyed it. They've been able to have their income and actually not do any work. But going on to unemployment benefit is a whole different package. And it would just be extremely damaging for everybody. It's so easy, in a way, I'm afraid, to go on it. At least I hope so, having helped design some of it in the end. But it's very difficult to get off it, to get new jobs. So I think that it is rightly, absolutely at the centre of the government's thinking.
And Prime Minister Mulroney, that must be a concern internationally. You've run a country. Is thoughts of unemployment going to those levels? How concerning is do you find that?
Well, I think it's absolutely key in the thinking of policymakers. It has to be that Canada, on a per capita basis, is doing pretty well, the same as the United Kingdom and the United States. But given the enormous size of the American economy and its capacity to drive investment and recovery, right, both at home and around the world, that's the worrisome part of it there. My point simply is that unemployment is coming down in the United States quite dramatically, but it's been artificial so far, sustained by massive infusions of fresh capital from the Fed and, of course, from the Treasury. And it seems to be in a period of decline. But my concern is, if that is so, what happens if the whole thing is interrupted in August by the fact that the United States and other countries have begun the work of getting back to work too soon, too quickly, open the economy, as President Trump says all the time. I understand that, and I sympathize with him completely. That said, the most important component in any political analysis these days, or economic, has to be the health issue. people will not send their children back to school if they think harm might come to them. And the same is true of economies. Economies are just the human response to major developments. That's what it's all about, how we respond. And I think that there seems to be the impression that, things are getting better. And look, let's forget all of these worries that Dr. Fauci and his colleagues tell us about every day. Let's forget that for the moment. And let's get back to work. In the process of doing that, we break every protocol that the wise men have put out there for us. And this could be calamitous, even with a comeback in the autumn. Now, somebody as sharp as Steve Schwarzman from Blackstone, said the other day that he sees a recovery, a V recovery. And given Mr. Schwartzman's brilliance and his success, I'd certainly defer to that. But even that can be broken by a return too quickly and without the necessary protocols to work in the United Kingdom, in Canada, and the United States.
And Oliver, you brought in this idea about tech, and I think there's quite a bit to unpack in terms of that. The tech has kept the American stock markets buoyant and other stock markets around the world. You didn't seem to be that confident that about other businesses. Are you worried that those businesses that you said are going to go aren't going to be replaced, or that the struggle around that? Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah, I can do it. If I could refer back to things that Amber and Wolf said, actually, because they're both crucial. Amber pointed out number 10's thinking about 4.5 million unemployed in the short term. That will be a record leap ever, I think, from the level we're at now. It's more than double the level we were pre-coronavirus. We've never experimented with such a sharp uptick in unemployment, and it's very hard to predict what that'll do to the economy, especially when, as Wolf and Brian have said, there's an element of intangible fear around. And even those who have kept their jobs, A, are going to be afraid of losing them, and B, are going to be afraid in terms of, do they send kids back to school, do they go back to the shops, do they go back into the office, all this kind of stuff, do they spend and consume in the usual way? And this sort of leads on to your point, because the consumer economy is so important in the UK. It's 2/3 of GDP, roughly. And it's a quite sort of confidence-based, debt-based thing. If we see that really contract sharply, the ripple out across all different sectors is going to be horrendous. And I think retailing, we touched on in my opening remarks, that was already structurally challenged. It's a huge employer in the UK. I think you would bet very, very hard against that in any kind of physical form, albeit, Amazon, ASOS, Boohoo, all these kind of companies, Ocado, keep on doing very well because they haven't got they're not encumbered by the legacy store estates and the costs and the overheads. And I think things like car making, which again is huge in the UK, particularly the West Midlands, Jaguar, Land Rover, these kind of employers are going to find it very, very hard. And again, the car industry was struggling with issues pre-coronavirus around the switch to electric, the sort of pressure on costs, people renting more and buying less. And it's going to be a very, very nasty outlook globally for car consumption. And in the UK, that's going to have a big impact on the workforce and factories in places like Solihull. And I think you would feel very bearish about those kind of industries.
And Amber, sticking with this idea of tech, I mean, you mentioned the app. When this app was discussed in terms of track and trace and that kind of thing, I remember very clearly at the beginning people saying, look, unless it works on Apple technology, it's useless. But the government went ploughing ahead and thought it knew better. And actually, lo and behold, 3 months later, it turns out they couldn't do it. And Apple just didn't help out and didn't help. Are we seeing a sense in which, the tech companies are more powerful, bigger than governments, and governments are learning a difficult lesson in this?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're seeing. I mean, tech commentators have been saying for a while, governments come and go and the tech giants just stay and hold their own line. And that is exactly what we're seeing. And I just sympathize with Matt Hancock's experiences because I had a similar one on security matters when I couldn't believe that Apple wouldn't help us in terms of trying to track down terrorists, but they just hold their line on the basis that home secretaries and governments come and go.
And I was interested as well, Wolf, in terms of you were talking about that the route out of this is, you know, basic economics is that there's a paradox of thrift. If people aren't spending money, then the economy can't get going. And that the governments are hoping that that people will start spending. Isn't it the case, and I'd like to bring in everybody on this, that habits appear to have changed? I mean, anecdotally, and it's all very dangerous when, you know, looking at anecdotes, but I've spoken to people and they're saying, I'm not really sure I want to go to the shops anymore, or that I do want to spend my Saturday night in a restaurant which has got a partition, or wait for a pub table, that kind of thing. We'll just talk to that about habits changing and the impact of that on the economy.
I think that depends very much from country to country. So the advantage in the, if you compare the UK to some of the continental European economies here, is that online shopping is much more developed in terms of infrastructure, habits of people, than it is in countries like Germany, France, and even and Italy. So that, I think, it helped so far. But what is really striking coming out from the research that we have seen is that the fear factor is a key driver here. And it's not the fear whether I will go into a physical shop or buy something online. No, it's the fear that the disease is going to be around for the foreseeable future, and therefore, do I really need to buy a new phone? Do I really need to buy a new coat? And therefore, people are postponing that. In terms of numbers, the Harvard report indicated that the top wealthy earners in the US, they cut down spending at some point by 31%. So these are not people who have an issue of income. This is the top income class in the US. So it's not a concern about the income. It was not the restriction, because in the US, the restriction at the end of the day were fairly mild if we compare to some of the European countries. It's the fear of the disease being around for a long time, and therefore I'm not gonna spend. That is the critical fact. So if we turn it around, then it becomes crucial for governments to win the economic battle, to reassure the public that the virus is under control, that the system of tracking, of tracing, isolating is in place, especially in the moment in which you're gonna see outbreaks, because outbreaks are inevitable. And then you need to reassure the public that you're able to contain them, because if that is not there, then you are in trouble.
And Prime Minister Mulroney, you very, very clear that we need to listen to their health advice on this, and very concerned about second spike. But also, you ran a country, you know how economies thrive on spending and that kind of thing. And there can be a huge knock-on impact if people aren't spending, if the economy isn't going, the social impact, we talked a bit about unemployment. You must also be worried about the economic effects of all of this.
Well, yes, of course. We were on, for example, to come back to the United States, they were on a path to enormous economic success, almost there in terms of unemployment, black unemployment, Hispanic unemployment, employment for women, and so on. They were doing a fantastic job. The lowest unemployment, general unemployment record ever in the history, recent history of the United States. Same is true of Canada and the other allied countries. But this has gone to hell in a handbasket now. And one of the big problems, sobering problems for all of us, is going to be, once we get through this, and we will, when the vaccine is produced, you know, what are we going to do with our books? How are we going to pay for the extraordinary expenditures that of necessity we have made? I remember coming in and being overwhelmed way back then, the good old days with Margaret Thatcher and others. I can remember coming in being overwhelmed by a deficit of 8.7% of GDP from Pierre Trudeau, which is the largest deficit in the history of Canada. And that was, I think, $32.5 billion then. Well, there was about $90 billion today. The deficits are going to run in the hundreds and hundreds of billions in countries our size. And the longer perspective is going to be a big one. And how you deal with it, Amber touched on something that, if I'll just digress for a second to make this point. Big tech. Well, There seems to be a direct challenge by big tech to the sovereignty of our nations. And who in the hell do they think they are? Whereby terrorists can't be tracked, taxes don't have to be paid, this kind of thing. And their hegemony, their intellectual hegemony, is truly extraordinary. And it's a challenge to our sovereignty and to our leadership of great nations. And that, in the fullness of time, must be dealt with because it's a growing concern. As you pointed out, Oliver, I think, that they're dragging the stock market up because they're so powerful and so prosperous. But they must be brought under control. And I agree fully with Amber about that point. It's a smaller part, perhaps, in the reconstruction of our economic prospects going forward, because we must deal with the legacy of what we're doing now to keep everybody afloat.
And Oliver and Amber, just on this point about habits changing, it sounds just from the tone of the conversation that that's deeply concerning, the way that people's habits are changing and their unwillingness to spend. Can you see any evidence of positives in that, particularly for the economy? Oliver, with you first.
I suppose, as you said, it's dangerous to draw too much from anecdotal evidence. And I think in terms of shopping, it's looking quite tough. I think in terms of, you know, eating out, socializing, those kind of things, we're all social animals in the end, aren't we? You look at parks across the UK the past few weeks, people's instinct is to go out and see their friends, have some food, have a drink. And I do think that will return over time. I suppose the question is, in terms of the economy and jobs and companies, how quickly it returns and in what format, because the plastic divides and the distancing and bringing your own wine and this kind of stuff isn't going to enhance the eating out experience. And you can see plenty of restaurants going to the wall before people do return, but I think that side will come back over time.
But Amber, this is the classic paradox of thrift, though, isn't it? The government's desperate for everybody to go out and spend their cash, but for an individual at a time when there are so many worries about potential job losses and, you know, a second spike and that kind of thing, it doesn't make sense not to have a sort of personalised war chest of money.
Yes, I mean, I completely agree. I rather think, though, that one of the reasons why the government is trying to keep us in the UK so that we spend more of our money in the UK, so that, you know, staycations and going to stay in UK hotels may at least have a breather over the summer if everybody can't rush out to warmer parts of the world.
Right. So on this, Alice Hunt is asking a question here. Brian's point about unimaginable deficits is sobering. Does he see a possibility of a global reset or rewriting of debt, or are we already too much in China's clutches on debt to do this?
No, we can do it. And the idea of a global resetting is for debate. But global meetings at the highest levels to deal with this must take place, which is why the leadership that I mentioned initially in the United States and the necessity of cooperating so closely with G7 allies and others is absolutely vital in any reasonable thought of being able to come back from this economically. Now, deficits, one Canadian once said, don't worry about them, they're only people, it's only money we owe each other. Well, unless you have to pay for it. And so I think that's a very good question and a very relevant point, that the state of our finances is going to be something for important for our recovery. But once the recovery is well underway with the vaccine, then we can start looking at that. But look, it's going to take us 10 or 15 years, 20 years perhaps, before we work ourselves out of this mountain of debt that of necessity we're creating for each other and for ourselves.
Wolf, I'm interested in what you were talking about, how the COVID is growing in different countries around the world. And I suppose what people are really struggling with is there really a lot of evidence that it will take hold again? Or actually, has it been overestimated? Is that too naive a question to say at the moment? Is that, you know, has the science gone in a direction that we can have any certainty on this? Or do you think we should just be as nervous as possible. I mean, for example, there's a lot of stuff in the papers today saying if you're under 50, you're more chance of dying in an accident. If you're under 30, you've virtually no chance of dying of COVID, that kind of thing. We're learning more and more and more about its real impacts and who it affects. Isn't that a way of controlling this going forward, or do we really just have to be that nervous about a second spike?
The car come, you see the car coming, you don't see the virus coming. So I don't know, I think we are discovering more, but we are still far away from what we can see around, from anything that can broadly reassure the public. So for example, weeks ago we were toying with the idea that in warm climates the virus struggles to spread. Well, looking what's going on in Texas and Arizona, or even in Qatar or in Saudi Arabia, where the rate now is 15%, that doesn't seem too old. So we are not at the point here, we are collecting all sorts of data, but we are not at the point where anything we have discovered so far is somewhat reassuring my way. There was the idea, for example, at the very beginning, that poor countries will be affected more than rich countries. Well, if we look at the leading countries in terms of cases right now, it's the US. I'm talking about positive cases for 100 people, 100,000 people, is the US, is Sweden, is Qatar, not exactly the poorer country in the world. So to me, there are still plenty of uncertainties out there. And as we've discussed already, there is still a game, each country on its own, pretty much. And that is a further complication. And my concern is that with the economy picture getting worse, because so far it's been sustained by this incredible stimulus and so on, the temptation by political leaders will be to insist on this more unilateral approach rather than a global approach.
And a few questions coming through, Brian Amber, about countries that are particularly touched by populism. So obviously the United States, Bolsonaro in Brazil, some might even venture Boris in the UK having it particularly bad. Do you think that the COVID crisis is going to have an impact on populist leaders and people will see that they've struggled, or is that a naive thing? So Amber, let's start with you on that.
Well, I think that one of the issues that plays towards populist leaders is the issue of protectionism, and there is a sort of good form of protectionism in a way and a bad form, the good form being there's a reasonable assessment that people have made, and we in the UK are now making, that you need to have in the UK sufficient of your own PPE for emergencies. You need to make sure that you can withstand this sort of event with your own resources, perhaps not be so China dependent, etc., etc. But it also teeters sometimes on the you know, full-blown nationalism type protectionism, which is dangerous, which of course Trump is leading on. And I think it's difficult to see yet which way it's going to go. But I'm alarmed in a way that the logical elements of protectionism can be a gateway to the sort of nationalism which is so dangerous.
And Brian, looking across the border, do you see a populist president being returned? Yvonne is asking that question on our chat. Do you think that he's going to thrive and prosper in November, or do you think it's going to be a problem for him?
Well, I think it's going to be a very tight election, no matter what. The country is just polarized like no one has ever seen before. And the vicious nature of the political dialogue is extraordinary. I mean, you can turn on television channels here and get nothing but anti-Trump or anti-Biden. On the other hand, it's an extraordinary situation that I've never even thought I'd ever hear in the United States. Look, the issue is going to be, and Amber is completely right, this protectionist stuff is nonsense. President Reagan used to say, protectionism is destructionism. And he was 100% right. Anybody who thinks that they can hive off their countries and smash other incoming countries' products have got to be nuts. They've taken leave of their senses. Because Bill Clinton once said that leadership is the capacity to look around the corner of history just a little bit. Well, you look around the corner of history just a little bit, you see what is absolutely required is strong international leadership with a vision for greatness for all participants under American leadership, commercial, industrial, military, and what have you around the world. And so the issue, I think, in the campaign is going to be, in American campaign, is going to be leadership. Who do you trust to get us out of this mess on the one hand, and who do you trust to provide decent, thoughtful, generous leadership that will benefit the United States of America and her allies? That's the question that I think is going to be asked and answered in the election and in others as well. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about the Brexit arguments and so on. And one of the arguments that I saw coming forward was, well, don't worry, because the United Kingdom is going to negotiate one hell of a great free trade agreement with the United States. And this is going to be a piece of cake. You just watch and see. The Anglo-Saxon alliance. Yes, eh? People who say that have not dealt with the United States in important international bilateral negotiations. And they are going to get one hell of a surprise if they think that the treaty with the United States is going to compensate for the loss of business that they have at their greatest with their greatest trading ally, namely Europe. So all of this is going to take place, and the people who said these things and who did these things are going to pay a price, because that does not equate with leadership. In my judgment, it's the antithesis of generous, broad-minded, effective international leadership.
Well, it's actually the fourth anniversary of the Brexit vote yesterday, so timely comment. We're coming towards the end of the call, and we've got one question here, which is basically I would like to put to all of you, starting with you, Oliver, which is essentially about how businesses behaved during this, executive remuneration, state aid, how employees have been treated. How do you think people will look back on how businesses behaved, Oliver, and do you think that it's actually been fast enough and kept up?
It's maybe a bit of a cop-out, but I think it's been a mixed picture. You've seen people like the supermarkets doing quite well, keeping supply chains going. You've seen the banks in general doing their best to support SMEs through things like B bills and C bills. On the other side, you have seen people use the crisis as cover and a bit of a sort of carte blanche to do things they wanted to do anyway. You've got BA cutting 12,000 jobs in a very tough way. You've got other companies cutting jobs even while people are on furlough. You've had some examples of people using furlough money and taxpayer support they don't really need. So I think it has been a mixed picture. It always will be. The key thing really is who emerges the winners from this, and how do they behave when they emerge with greater clout? Because I think most industries are going to be shaken down. You're going to have fewer, bigger survivors. And the question for them is how they behave, and the question for governments is how they rein them in.
And Oliver, Sally Osmond's just asking about the relationship with government. I think that you said this week that the honeymoon was over. I was surprised that you thought there had actually been a honeymoon with business. But yeah, how do you think this government's relationship with business is going to be? Do you think they're going to have to work much closer, or do you think it's going to actually continue to be quite fractious?
It's going to be tough. I think I made the point in the column that Boris wasn't Corbyn, which was a key qualification for business support last year. And also he has a certain sort of optimistic, quite libertarian exterior, which is quite appealing, at least superficially, to business leaders who are often quite similar characters. I think they've been dismayed by the way he's handled the past 4 months and the cabinet. And we forget sometimes business leaders are very accustomed to executing these big, complex strategic projects of the kind that lockdown has been. And so they can see the flaws in the communication and the execution very clearly. And there's a long way to go to build back. And don't forget, I think I forgot to mention in the column, but you know, business leaders, most of them are parents, parenting and juggling home life, work life have been a key new challenge for businesses throughout this period. And the sort of mess over schools is another thing that has really upset and aggravated quite a few of them. So it's a long road back in terms of shoring up confidence and support.
Amber, your thoughts on the relationship between business and government? It's usually a strength for Conservatives, but it's been a bit tricky, isn't it?
Well, I'm afraid I think that Brexit has ended that in terms of a strong relationship. And of course, business leaders are about to go into the further volatility of Brexit over the next few months. But to answer your sort of earlier question of what they can do, you know, we haven't mentioned in this call the whole Black Lives Matter, race issues and diversity issues that have been dominating really media and campaigns for the past few weeks. And I think to use Prime Minister Mulroney's example about leadership being looking around the corner, I think that corporates who look around the corner will see that they need to address diversity, and they need to do that in a way that they can actually show leadership on to their employees and nationally. And I think that will help them get ahead.
Prime Minister Mulroney, when you were leading Canada, a lot of people felt that it was really very much about how much money can you generate, how many jobs can you generate. A lot of people feel there's been a very big shift in terms of the values that people have and the expectations of business. Your observations on that?
Well, back then, you know, we dealt with the problem of South Africa and the liberation of Mandela, which was a cause, a great cause for the Commonwealth for many years. So that and you know, all kinds of other such matters were dealt with. But it's true that we were coming out of a recession, very serious economic challenges, mostly debts and deficits, high interest rates, and so on, and high inflation rates. So all of this had to be brought under control, which, as Mrs. Thatcher found in the United Kingdom, and I found, Reagan found in the United States, and I found in Canada, was extremely difficult and debilitating. But we did have time. We got it done. In all three countries and all the G7 countries. We got it done, but we have all the scars to prove it. This was a brutal time in politics, but it was mostly on the economic side. Now it's only more socially oriented. Amber was quite right in pointing out that Black Lives Matter and the tremendous impact that it's had on the debate here. Look, in American channels, I mean, it's squeezed out for entire days and days and days, any discussion really of the virus, which to me was astounding, but true. It's the next election is going to be one, obviously, on leadership, but on leadership with a social dimension, a respect for what is going on in human lives. And so, you know, we like to focus on the economic numbers and how well people have done and how quickly we're going to be able to come out of this thing. But we can't forget that there's a human being behind every statistic. And now it is a compelling, urgent matter for us to attend to. So while we had our own share of social challenges, of course, nothing like today, nothing like today. And I can only wish all of our present leaders well as they try and do this to our satisfaction.
And Wolf, just in a sentence, do you think that all this chat about values and expectations on business is going to evaporate in the face of economic reality, or do you think it's here to stay?
Oh, for me, the big test is when all the shock absorbers that are in place will come to an end. That is a real test for businesses in terms of their social responsibility. Now is easy talk because the government is pumping in money, is paying the salaries. When the system, when this is brought down, let's see the music then.
Well, thank you. We're coming to the end now. That was a really fascinating discussion. Lots of big topics there. Just to let you know that next week that we are going to have another great panel, which is including Carol Sikora, who's one of the doctors who's really led the debate on this in this country. But in the meantime, I'd like it if you could all give your usual virtual round of applause to Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, Oliver Shaw from the Sunday Times, Amber Rudd and Wolf Pickley. Thank you very much. They were all great, and we will see you next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.